From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Lightning storms inside the Arctic Circle, severe forest fires flaring across the Arctic. Those scenarios are unthinkable, and they're real. Now imagine Iceland without ice. Could happen, and soon. The last 5 years have been the hottest on record in the globe's northernmost expanse, melting centuries-old glaciers and speeding the release of carbon into the heavens. Scientists are expressing alarm, entrepreneurs are seeking advantage, and military adversaries are flexing muscle. This hour On Point, the changing Arctic climate and how it affects us all. Join us. What questions do you have about how the climate is affecting the Arctic, from its oceans to its wildlife to the recent string of wildfires? For those who have visited over the years, what have you seen? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Julie Brigham Gretty. She's a professor of glacial geology at the University of Massachusetts, and she's done extensive research on the Arctic region throughout her career. She's also head of the Department of Geosciences, which conducts research in the areas of global climate change and earth dynamics. Julie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
And with me here in our studios in New York City, Andrew Revkin. He's the founding director of the Initiative on Communication and Sustainability at the Earth Institute of Columbia University. For more than two decades, he covered environmental issues and global warming for the New York Times, where I met him. He's the author of the book, The North Pole Was Here. Andrew, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be here.
So, Andrew, let's start with you. The last half decade has been the hottest on record in the Arctic, and it's received widespread attention, I'd say, particularly over the last year, especially this summer. CBS News anchor Rena Ninen offered this report in June on the dire situation, and that's a situation which has continued over the last 2 months.
Nearly half of Greenland's ice sheet began melting this week after an unprecedented warm spell hit the Arctic region. Temperatures were more than 40 degrees above average, leading to an estimated 2 billion tons of ice loss.
So, Andrew Revkin, just paint with a broad brush here. Tell us what the heck is happening up there.
It's warming, and it's warming about twice as fast as the global average temperature is warming. The planet's warming. Greenhouse gases from human activities are now the dominant thing driving this. And for a bunch of reasons, some are simple, some are complicated. The Arctic heats up quicker. And Greenland is a big pile of ice, and these as weather systems move around, you get these hot blobs of air like we've had here and in Europe they've had, can move up into the polar regions, and the surface of Greenland can melt. Now, it's been kind of overplayed to some extent. The media latch on to figures like it was melting across the entire surface of Greenland. It's a true fact, but when I was there, when you're on Greenland, you're on it's a chunk of ice that's five times bigger than California, and it's an ice sheet. It's about 2 miles thick at the top. So it's like the frosting on a cake melting, meaning it can get mushy, but the whole cake is not melting. And it'll take centuries for the full force of the warming that we're seeing now to start to sort of build a meaningful pulse from that. And it's a hard question for scientists to figure out how long it takes for that to turn into many feet of sea level rise is an important question.
It's always nice to hear that things are being exaggerated, not because I like exaggerations, because maybe things are a little less dire. Even go a little bit more broad than that. We obviously led with a thing that was about Greenland, which is at once consequential and big, you know. And I do recall I led with Iceland a little bit. I recall as a student at some point being said, well, you know, Greenland is really more about ice and Iceland is really more about, you know, like land in certain ways. But tell us about the Arctic region more broadly.
Yeah.
You know, you said it's heating up faster than the rest of the world, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why is this important? Why does it matter?
Well, it's important for sea level because of Greenland. That's the thing that matters for sea level. Down in Antarctica, there's vastly more ice that also is melting. And there are now some new studies show that the signal of human influence on that is becoming perceptible. These are big chunks of ice. There's been warming of the Earth, you know, on a longer time scale since the end of the last ice age. And it's hard to sort of say, bingo, this is us. And it's hard to say, bingo, this is many feet of sea level rise in our lifetime, sort of like. So that's the Greenland part, the sea level part. The Arctic also is tundra, and frozen landscapes are melting. I first reported on that in 2003 in Alaska. And when permafrost becomes impermanent, all kinds of things can happen. Forests tip sideways. You get the fires that we've seen in Siberia. The boreal forest, which is this big ring of bigger forests, tundra is like shrubby stuff. And the trees in the northern hemisphere are up near the poles, or this boreal area. Siberia If anyone just Googles for Siberian fire right now, you'll see some pretty amazing images.
I want to play a clip now from what's been happening, just to give people a feel for what that news sound like. The fires erupting this summer across the Arctic are said to have far-reaching consequences. And I want to play an excerpt from a report from July on the Euro News Network.
The current heat wave is a devastating cycle of cause and effect. Forest fires in Alaska and within the Arctic Circle haven't just been caused in part by global warming, they're also contributing to it. Vast swathes of woodland are burning in northern extremes in Russia, the US and Canada. An unprecedented wave of destruction in highly ecologically sensitive regions of the planet.
Julie Brigham Gretty, let's bring you in here. Let's start with the question of the fires, and then we'll go more broadly. How unusual is it for there to be fires in northern reaches of Alaska, fires in Siberia, as we've just heard from Andy Revkin, fires within the Arctic region?
Well, there normally are fires in various tundra regions, but it's the sheer volume and extent of them that's really becoming unprecedented. Geologists are working as we speak to reconstruct what the fire history has been over the last few thousands, tens of thousands of years to provide a comparison. But certainly this is quite unprecedented, and we're looking back to previous warm periods to determine the extent to which today's extent of fires are kind of similar to previous warm periods, and trying to get a better understanding. But certainly they're widespread, and of course there's more infrastructure to get in the way of these fires today.
So you study, as I understand it, sort of broad periods of not human history, but global history and thinking about these things, right? A period of something like 2.8 million years, is that right?
I've been studying the kind of the climate evolution of the Arctic, starting about 3.6 million years ago when the Arctic was forested, 3.6, and we didn't really have much of a Greenland ice sheet back then. There were tidewater glaciers on the east side of Greenland, but nothing like today. And so how do we go from that forested Arctic into the one that cycles through the ice ages? And what were previous warm periods like naturally without human influence? So what I like to do is in my work is really put today's the consequences in the perspective of what we know about the past.
And so what consequences do you see as things heat up at a more rapid pace in the Arctic, as some of the glaciers are surely melting? What are the implications of that? And what are you seeing in terms of this being part of unprecedented behavior, or this being part of a normal fluctuation? You know, people often say, "Hey, if you look at the greater trends of global climates, that there are grand ups and grand downs." And this is, in some ways, one could look at it in that context.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there are warm periods and cold periods, and we've been in a relatively warm period for about 10,000 years, but that was under greenhouse gases with CO2 at around 280 parts per mil for most of, particularly the last 5,000 years. And yet what we're doing now, we've already within 120 years, we're now at 414 parts per mil, way outside of the normal range of atmospheric CO2. And we haven't seen anything like this really since about 3 million years ago. So this is why looking at what the Arctic was like 3 million years ago gives us an idea that this is the Earth system is driving us toward this forested, unglaciated Arctic, and with consequences for Antarctica. So we measure the sensitivity of the Arctic system by looking at previous warm periods and then realizing that today the human-induced use of fossil fuels is driving us now into what we geologists call the Pliocene 3 million years ago. And if we don't do something soon, we're going to be heading back to the Eocene 50 million years ago with different kind of consequences. And this is happening really fast. One story I like to tell to get this in context is that when my grandmother was born in 1895, CO2 was at 285 parts per mil. When my parents were born in the 1920s, we had around 300, 310 parts per mil. And, you know, when I was born in 1955, it was only about 320. And, of course, now with my, as my children were born, it was at 350, and now we're at 414. So in a matter of 120 years since my grandmother was born, we've massively changed the atmosphere.
And this carbon dioxide.
And this is carbon dioxide, and of course we're contributing a lot of methane. And what's quite frightening too is what scientists are now realizing, those people working in permafrost, is that there are new areas of abrupt thaw of that permafrost that are releasing tremendous volumes of methane and CO2. Mm-hmm. Abrupt thaw that's much more rapid than the normal just thaw through the active layer across much of the Arctic. There are large areas undergoing rapid thaw. Mm-hmm. And so this information is really new and very important to the UN IPCC process and going forward, because it means that we really need to buckle down on fossil fuels in order to turn this around.
Andy Revkin, in the 30 seconds before the end of this segment of our show, President Trump announced he wants to purchase Greenland. Yeah. Like, he's going to go get it. What does that mean? What implications are there for what we're talking about?
Well, it's a microcosm of something that all the Arctic nations have, this kind of two-sided approach. There are opportunities up there going forward, and there's countries that are already vying for the resources that are there, too. I think Trump is just kind of a caricature of this broader sense that this is also an opportunity as well as a nightmare.
And we'll be talking about some of both the nightmares and the opportunities in the segments to come. We're discussing the Arctic and the consequences of its shifting climate. It's drawing grave scientific concern and also great corporate and strategic interest. Join our conversation. What are your questions? What do you want to know about what already is being done to address climate change in the Arctic? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing climate change in the Arctic and the changes transforming the region as the temperature rises. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have about the changing face of the Arctic? For those who study this area professionally, what have you found? For those involved in shipping or other fields that see potential profits in the changes, where do you see opportunity? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Back with us is Julie Brigham Gretty. She's a professor of glacial geology at the University of Massachusetts, who has studied the Arctic and climatology extensively. And of course, with me in studio once more, Andrew Revkin, the founding director of the Initiative on Communication and Sustainability at the Earth Institute at Columbia University and a former lead columnist on climate for the New York Times. We are starting to get calls in. We're getting a lot of comments online as well. Brian Schreiber writes on Facebook, Arctic on fire. Just those three little words gives me the feeling in my face like I want to cry, the feeling in my face. But nothing will be done, he writes. It's too late. We failed. We'll see at that hour whether that is the case. Neil Blanchard writes, in another aspect of melting land ice is that it reduces the gravitational pull nearby. That raises sea level around it. Antarctica is particularly important, about 2.5 miles of ice that is pressing the land under it down by almost a half mile, raising the sea level around it and shifting the bulge at the equator. If Antarctica ice totally melted, then eventually the northern hemisphere will gain about 100 feet more than the southern hemisphere. I'm going to bounce that off our guests in a moment. First, I want to give you the sound of what that is like. There's the sea ice at the North Pole, and it was only a few feet thick in 2003 when my guest Andrew Revkin stood on its surface and captured footage to document this excursion. Here's just a taste of what the sound of the ice is like. It kind of sounds like a train there, and that's cracking apart. What did it look like?
Well, it was in that case, it was the surging, the ice flows are like, some of them could be miles across, and they they're moving. I wrote a book about this in 2006 called The North Pole Was Here, because the camp we were on was drifting. Like, we were at the North Pole and we moved. And the ice, when these giant plates of ice are rubbing up against each other, they form ridges. And that was what was happening there. Some of it was like the squeaking that you get when you take the lid off of a styrofoam container. Uh-huh. But like magnified, I don't know how many decibels. It was really startling. And I turned to the scientist, Tim Stanton. The clip is on YouTube. And I said, should we back up? There were cracks you could see in the ice under our feet. He said, oh, you can always jump over a crack. I'm like, okay.
Pretty blasé.
Yeah. And, you know, that camp, they were setting this up annually every spring after the North Pole darkness, you know, ebbs. And it's much harder logistically to do this kind of thing now because the ice is more unpredictable. There's much less of what they call multi-year ice, ice that survives one summer and builds even thicker. So that sheath of floating sea ice, which is different than that miles-high ice on Greenland and Antarctica, is deteriorated to a point where in summer, later in summer, like around September, there's a minimum, and that minimum could be a maximum pretty soon in terms of like pretty much open water across the Arctic Ocean.
So to tell me about that, I mean, that is, you know, centuries ago, you know, explorers wanted to find a mythical Northwest Passage that would make it easier to go from the Atlantic to the Pacific and all this stuff. What actually happens? What things open up if those are open waters, essentially?
Well, it's a huge potential time saver and money saver and fuel saver and greenhouse gas emission saver for shipping. If you can take a new material in a container from Korea or China north across the top of the world, it's much closer to go to Europe or the United States across the top than to go around the fat belly of the world. And that's one of the things that's happening. In 2010, I wrote a piece for .earth, my Times blog, called Arctic Shipping Gets Boring. That was 2010 because it was now so getting so routine.
I want to play, you know, there are others that have apprehended this possibility. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the evolving climate in the region presents great economic prospects for those able to capitalize. He spoke at a meeting of the Arctic Council in May.
The Arctic is at the forefront of opportunity and abundance. It houses 13% of the world's undiscovered oil, 30% of its undiscovered gas, and an abundance of uranium, rare earth minerals, gold, diamonds, and millions of square miles of untapped resources, fisheries galore. And its centerpiece, the Arctic Ocean, is rapidly taking on new strategic significance.
Tell us a little bit. I mean, there are these opportunities, right, to do these things. He's, you know, we've heard that there's the ability to save and to reduce, you know, carbon emissions into the climate, at least compared by current technologies. If you reduce shipping distances and ships, I'm told, are a significant contributor to what happens here. At the same time, you know, among the things that he's talking about are untapped resources. I assume some of those are fossil fuels. Like what happens if we tap those fuels that are underneath the Arctic that would suddenly be revealed by the melting of these caps?
Yeah, I think the opening up of the Arctic is producing winners and losers, and it certainly depends on your perspective. Personally, I think we need to leave fossil fuels in the ground because we're already at a point where we need to extract the remnants of that from the atmosphere in order to cool the planet. On the other hand, there are people who only see dollars and cents and want to have access to those. So, you know, we're seeing a land grab going on through the UN process for the Law of the Sea. Arctic nations are trying to claim and extend their exclusive economic zone out into the center of the Arctic Ocean, where now there's going to be no sea ice in summer, and therefore be able to have the right to extract resources from there. Another thing that's happening with the sea ice as it goes north is, of course, the commercial fisheries are moving north. And at least for commercial fishing, there is now a moratorium that I think started through the Arctic Council that there will be no commercial fishing in the Arctic, Central Arctic Ocean until we figure out how these fish are going to survive, what you know, who owns what. And that's actually a wonderful international collaboration, but when it comes to natural resources, we'll probably have a very different game. But that land grab through the Law of the Sea process is really an important one to watch.
You know, we have another writer write in who says we're going to be fine. Our emissions are down more than the signatories to Paris. I think what the Honest Debate 2 is writing on the website is to suggest that emissions are down more than was required under the Parisian Accord. I see you nodding, Andy Revkin. Is that right? And does that mean that in some ways maybe this is being mitigated in a way, even if the U.S. isn't a participatory in that deal?
Oh, my gosh. It's U.S. emissions have been down. They blipped up last year, and they're on a downward track again. But that's mainly because we're shifting from coal to natural gas for electricity production. Mm-hmm. The world still is on a rising path on emissions and will be for decades to come, because the developing world, even the countries that are poorer than China, India, and are there surging, and they are saying, we need to develop. We own whatever carbon space is left in the atmosphere. And so the world, and the other thing that's really hard, that makes this a super wicked problem, as one scientist put it a long time ago, is CO2, carbon dioxide, the main heat-trapping gas, is long-lived. It builds in the atmosphere. It doesn't care if, slowing down the growth rate doesn't do anything to reduce the amount in the atmosphere. And that makes it more like unpaid credit card debt. If anyone out there has credit card debt, you know that slowing your spending doesn't take away your debt. So we have a climate debt that's building and building, and there's inertia in the system too, which guarantees that we have to work really hard on adaptation and resilience and thinking about sea level in ways we hadn't thought about before. And and that is part of our future, period, even if those who would seek an abrupt change have a success.
We're getting some interesting calls on the line. Let's take one now from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Pete, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in.
Hello. Yes, I'm curious about the potable water that we're losing through the non-industry that's not built up to collect the good potable water that is being melted off the poles. Is it a possibility to build a structure that we can collect that?
I'll throw that to you. You go ahead, Andy. You want to pop in. So potable water, meaning drinkable water. Pete, thanks for the call.
Well, nature does that. They're called icebergs. And there was some, I think I remember, if someone could Google out there, they'll get the answer, that I think Saudi Arabia or someone was exploring the idea of towing icebergs from the Arctic as a big source of water. So that's, it would be logistically really hard to think about the volumes you would need in cities that are running out of water, like happened in South America and South Africa the last few years, somehow having a pipeline to polar supplies. That seems like it's not going to happen in my lifetime.
We're now going to be joined from another scholar. Bryce Luce is joining us from Kingstown, Rhode Island, professor of oceanography at the University of Rhode Island and chief expedition scientist with the Northwest Passage Project. Professor Luce just returned earlier this month from an 18-day research expedition in the Arctic. Bryce Luce, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thanks. It's great to be here.
So tell us what you saw when you were up there.
We had quite an expedition. We were in a section of the Arctic known as the Northwest Passage, as you said, and this is basically a portion of the Canadian Arctic that transits essentially from the west coast of Greenland and Baffin Bay, and then kind of as you transit from east to west, you move through a section called Lancaster Sound, and then the Northwest Passage continues through a variety of pathways, but ships, when they're trying to navigate that, they basically choose the one that's the most ice-free, and they move from there. We were there early in the year, so we eventually encountered some pretty heavy ice and didn't proceed, all the way through the Northwest Passage. But I have to say that this was my fifth expedition to the Arctic, and it was by far the most, I would say, climatically pleasant conditions that I've ever experienced, which basically means warmer and calmer. So in years past, I've been accustomed to about every week to 10 days, there will be a frontal system that will come through and it will drop the temperature down to in the low 20s, even in the summertime, and you'll get some wind and you'll get some rain, and then that rain turns to snow. And so that's diagnostic, I would say, of, Arctic on a typical year. But this year, the winds were very mild. The temperatures were really warm. We returned to Greenland at the end of the Greenland heat wave, as it was referred to in the news. And we were experiencing temperatures in the mid-50s through much of the expedition. So anecdotally, it was a really, it was an eye-opener. Like, it was lovely for getting a lot of work done, but also really disconcerting considering what I know about the Arctic. And this is what I think has been driven home for us, especially with talking with the Nunavuts, the people who live up there year-round in the communities, and kind of have a history that goes, you know, many hundreds of years back. They just say that as time proceeds forward, the climate system and the weather basically just oscillate between these big extremes. So they'll have a really warm, dry year and then a really cold, wet year. And they may have a really heavy ice year and then a really minimal ice year. And that all of what they've kind of counted on is the baseline for their operations and for their hunting and everything that they do has been thrown out the window. And so they're grappling with how to sort of square that circle.
Bryce Luce, before we let you talk a little bit about the findings of your research, I wanted to take a call from Brattleboro, Vermont. Thank you, Mary, for listening to the show and for calling in.
All right. Thank you. So I have a question that involves the Gulf Stream. My understanding is that the balance between saltwater and freshwater at the Arctic is critical to keeping the Gulf Stream pumping along in a healthy way, and the influx of fresh water could potentially slow down what I've heard referred to as a pump that keeps that Gulf Stream and the North Atlantic Drift going. And so I don't know if that makes sense. I just want to make sure that people understand what I'm saying, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Well, let me first check that. Thank you for the question, Mary. Let me first go to Bryce Luce, if I could.
Yes. Yeah, so that's a great question, Mary. I think this is an interesting hypothesis that's been circulating in oceanography for maybe 30 years now, and it's the idea that in the North Atlantic, you produce this really cold water, which eventually becomes heavy enough to sink to the bottom of the ocean, and that happens just north of where the Gulf Stream starts to head east. So to some degree, Gulf Stream heat does contribute to the atmospheric warming that takes place in that same area. So what you have to imagine is, in the wintertime, a cold atmosphere sweeping over a relatively warm ocean, either warmed by the Gulf Stream or by this, you know, by this other seawater, and it picks up a lot of heat and it picks up a lot of water vapor, and then it wafts that over Europe, which is that's pretty conclusively determined that that's why Europe's climate is so mild, even in the winter. And so there has been this concern that, and even some evidence from the geologic record, that if you dump large amounts of fresh water on the North Atlantic, you can shut down the mechanism that we're describing. You basically push the Gulf Stream to the south. It doesn't turn the Gulf Stream off. It just reroutes it, and you can mitigate or basically shut down this deep water formation, which is another mechanism by which heat is transferred to the atmosphere. And that, of course, if that deep water formation is shut down, that has other much larger implications for the whole ocean current circulation system. So the downstream effects could also be very significant. And these are questions that are really actively being studied with large mooring arrays. And I think we don't know the answer yet, but we know that it's much more complex than we ever imagined. I think that's
I think that's probably uniformly true. And Bryce, before we let you go, I just want to give you a minute or so to talk a little bit about your actual findings yourself. You were looking at about the role of plastic and it turning up in ice core and in water up there. What'd you find?
Yes. Yeah, so we were there for a number of reasons. I'd say the plastic wasn't necessarily the main focus, but we were interested in looking at what the composition of sea ice cores. And we were kind of lucky because we basically stumbled into an ice field of multi-year ice, which, as Andy was saying earlier, is kind of a rarity. And actually, because of the history of this project, we're pretty sure that multi-year ice actually came down from the central Arctic through Nares Strait below, you know, between Greenland and Ellesmere Island, and then came into the area that we were in 2018 and then froze in place so that we found ourselves amongst it this year. And so we were able to sample ice that was 8 or 10 feet thick in some places. And that's remarkable because it's a much more rare occurrence to find such thick ice. And And that ice is much harder because it's lost all of its salinity, so it's much more like a freshwater ice. And so we were able to basically take several cores, and in examining those cores for multiple properties, we found a surprising amount of plastic in the ice cores. And so I think that was a shock.
That was a shock. A shocking finding from Bryce Luce, professor of oceanography at the University of Rhode Island and a chief scientist at a recently concluded research mission to the Arctic. Thanks so much for joining us. We're going to keep our other guests here with us. We're discussing global change and specifically changes to the Arctic. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the record hot temperatures besetting the Arctic and what that means for the region and what that means for us. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have for my guests? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, at On Point Radio. Andrew Revkin is with me here in studio. He's at the Earth Institute at Columbia University and a former longtime environmental reporter for the New York Times. Julie Brigham Gretty is a professor of glacial geology at the University of Massachusetts, and she has done extensive research on the Arctic region for decades. I want to read a little bit. It's a small passage of a piece written just a few days ago, posted a few days ago in National Geographic by Craig Welch. And among the many hats that Andrew Revkin has had, he was a strategic advisor over there for National Geographic Society, if I think I'm getting that right. Craig Welch writes, "Permafrost, that's the ground that remains frozen year-round, is capped by a few feet of dirt and plant detritus. Called the active layer, this soil normally thaws each summer and refreezes in winter, protecting permafrost from rising heat above. But in the spring of 2018, a crew found that dirt near the surface around the town of Cherskii, I believe, had not iced it up at all during the long, dark polar night. That was unheard of. January in Siberia is so brutally cold that human breath can freeze with a tinkling sound that the indigenous Yakuts call whisper of stars. The Soviets used to land heavy planes on the Kolyma. Soil 30 inches down should have been frozen. Instead, it was mush." I wonder, Andy Revkin, if you can talk to us a little bit about how this changing ground, this changing definition of the terrain in what had been the frozen Arctic affects both the wildlife that lives there, the fauna that lives there, the animals, and also what effects that have on the plants and the growth that crops up as a result.
It's all in a state of dramatic flux. In 2005, we did a series at the Times on the opening of the Arctic called Arctic Rush, a big melt. There was a film we made called Arctic Rush. And there was a village, Kivalina, at that time. They called this, it was like emergency. They called this environmental office in Alaska and said, "Hey, we've got a problem here. There's a big fish die off in our river." And it was salmon. There were all these dead salmon. They thought it was from a mine up the river. And what it was a salmon species that had not been spawning in that river that's moving its way north along rivers and started spawning there. And when salmon spawn, they die. That was 2005. There, in 2007, I wrote a really interesting on a paper by a Danish scientist who found that Arctic flora, Arctic plants in certain areas are very responsive to climate change. They have this ability to adapt because the Arctic has this kind of amplifier effect. It makes things warmer when it's warm and colder when it's cold. So the plants, some of the plants up there are adapted to this. Then polar bears, of course, you know, rely on sea ice. And this I've written a ton about. And 10 years ago, some colleagues at Columbia University at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory and elsewhere had proposed, they're starting to look ahead, as we all need to do, on this planet. And they created a conservation plan for polar bears by anticipating which parts of the Arctic Ocean, even in 2100, are still likely to have sea ice floating on the ocean, which is what polar bears rely on, where they hunt for seals and the like. And it's this area just west of Greenland, sort of in northern Canada, Ellesmere Island. And they started charting out this proposal to create a last ice area, kind of a refuge. And just this past week, Trudeau announced they're going to create a reserve there. So it's like anticipatory conservation. Where do we know polar bears might still have a chance in 2100, even with the warming and the change? And so the lesson there is nature has some responsiveness. The gray whales apparently went through the Arctic Ocean, like these ships that have recently gone through, from one ocean to the other that people hadn't anticipated. In that sense, nature is going to do its thing. If we give it a little room and do some anticipatory work, we can still save these species. But it's going to take work and imagination to do that.
Last year, Julie, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a special report on the impacts of global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Here is Jim Ski, a co-author of that report.
The key message is that we can keep global warming below 1.5 degrees C. It's possible within the laws of physics and chemistry, but it will require huge transitions in all sorts of systems, energy, land, transportation. But what the report has done is to send out a clear message to the governments that it is physically possible. It's now up to them to decide whether they want to take up the challenge.
Now, I got to say, Julie, we've been getting somewhat apocalyptic comments online. Bob Haig posts on Facebook, it's obvious that actions to prevent the catastrophic results of global warming should have begun decades ago. Once the permafrost thaws, it's game over. Another listener, Troy Johnson, writes, it's no huge mystery the path we're traveling. Greenland and Antarctica are also melting. Biodiversity devastated. Reports and science are clear as a bell. If the world does not come together and act in about 8 or 9 years with huge warlike efforts, life on Earth will die within a few generations. Julie Brigham Greedy, offer us some, rebut it or don't, offer us what you feel the facts show.
Well, yeah, I think I actually had the privilege to sit in on some of the discussions in Bonn, Germany in June for the IPCC discussions and how the countries are talking to each other about needing to keep emissions down so that we don't raise the planet any warmer. We've already raised the planet temperature 1 degree, so keeping it below 1.5 is absolutely crucial. And yet the current promises are really not good enough. They're still, the current levels of promises are driving us still toward a world that's 3 degrees above present, which puts us again back in the Pliocene. So I agree we've got to do something really quickly, and that takes great political will over the next few decades. I'm an optimist. I think we have to do it. And let me just put this in perspective. Recently gave a talk out at University of Oklahoma, and I said, you know, even though you live in Oklahoma, you need to worry about sea level and what's happening. The forecast is possibly as much as by the time Greta Thunberg is 97 years old, in her lifetime, sea level from Antarctica alone could go up as much as 50 to 60 centimeters or 2 or 3 feet. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but we're looking at having to move anywhere from 6 million to 13 million people from the Gulf Coast and Florida, get them out of harm's way. Who's going to pay for that? So our FEMA, the federal government, are going to have to do managed retreat, and yet we haven't even factored in the economic cost of that happening just within the next few decades. So we can adapt and try to be sustainable, but I think we really need to look at the consequences of just even sea level rise in our own country. If you think of all of those 6 million people as refugees, climate refugees in our own country, having to find a new place to go to school, a new place to work, new land to have a home. People are starting to talk about that, but that has grave implications. So when you wrap that all up, it makes the urgency of now, really important for doing something about our use of fossil fuels.
I want to take a call from Corinth, Vermont. Frank, thanks for listening. What questions do you have for my guests?
Thanks for having me on. I just have a question to your scientist on two established scientific theories. One, CO2 parts per million is being raised. So let's say we get to, unfortunately, inevitably we get to 600, 700 parts per million, but then we are in interglacial ice age periods. That's also a scientific fact. So that we've had 10 or 12 periods of warming, and usually a large part of the Earth is covered in glaciers. What happens when those collide? I don't think an ice age will happen tomorrow, but if we have 700 or 800 parts per million and an ice age comes along, which the science says it will eventually, what happens then? Thank you very much.
Thanks for your question, Frank.
It's in my book.
Andrew Upton says that's in his book. All right, so well, tell us what it says.
I first wrote in 2003 about this question of, you know, essentially, when will the next ice age come? And they're in the mix because of the orbits of the Earth and how it relates to the sun. It's going to return. But even then, in 2003, there were papers that were coming out saying that greenhouse warming is already dominating that little orbital forcing that gives the Earth its periodic ice ages, that we've essentially, as long as we're...
We've canceled out the laws of physics of the heavens.
Well, no, it's all the laws of the physics. We're not canceling...
We're overtaking them in some ways.
No,
well,
this is the idea of the Anthropocene, that we've become a geological powerhouse. And so on a long time scale, we are fending off already. There's already evidence that the slide in temperatures that has been happening on a time scale of millenniums is already slowed because of the warming. And there's a lot of uncertainty. This is such a big pulse of CO2 so fast that, as I'm sure Julie and others will know, there's wild cards here.
And Julie Brigham-Gretty, is that your sense as well?
Yeah, the what's happening in the atmosphere is by far taking over the very small orbital changes that normally drive glacial interglacial changes. So if we actually do reach 600, 800 parts per mil, again, by the time today's kindergartners are elderly people, we're talking about maybe 600, 800 parts per mil. I mean, that's a very different world. And we will have baked in, so to speak, enough heat in the oceans and the atmosphere that will cause both Antarctica to continue to collapse, particularly West Antarctica, and then more melt from Greenland. And you're right. It's going to take, even with a warmer world, it would take 4,000 to 5,000 years for all of Greenland to melt. But getting even 2 or 3 feet out of that in the next century is not impossible.
So, guys, before the hour gets away from us, and we have a bit of time left for sure, I want to talk a little bit about affirmative steps and about sort of thinking about this, because this stuff can devolve into despair a lot. You know, for listeners, for families, you talk about it. How can you possibly think in any way that's not just sort of despairing about what my children and grandchildren will experience? You know, should we be so fortunate? So what do you say about in terms of what's being done to mitigate, what's being done to accommodate, how we should think about and talk about these things? Let's start with you, Andrew Revkin. We've got about 5 minutes left.
Yeah, in a piece I did for Nat Geo when I was there this past year, I looked at the adaptation side of this, and which was consciously tamped down by many climate campaigners in the 30 years I've been writing about this. It was always kind of worried that there was this worry, if we focus too much on adapting, we won't do the hard job of cutting those emissions. Remember, it's like credit card debt. Man, it's hard, right?
Right.
And it's even harder with greenhouse gases. So it's like, but then, and Al Gore in 2002, in his first book on global warming in 2002, he wrote that adaptation was a form of laziness. So I asked his office when I was writing this piece, so what's he think about it now? And in a 2013 book that I hadn't seen this chunk of, and isn't really discussed. He said he was wrong. This is a quote, wrong in not immediately grasping the moral imperative of pursuing both policies simultaneously, in spite of the difficulty, meaning doing what we can to transform our energy systems and adapting. And one of the things I think is a really important opportunity, especially for young people and parents is to embrace the reality that somehow we have to come up with a new idea of how to have a coastal civilization. At Columbia, we recently had a two-day managed retreat meeting. What is that? How do you build a city that has no new normal coastline? We have to do that even with what we do on greenhouse gases. And that's a really important challenge. It's not going to be building walls. We know that doesn't work ultimately. So how do you create sort of an agile, flexible, learn and shift approach to city design is a key part of where we go from here and on coastlines. And that's just a model for this bigger challenge of how to act even with this grand challenge. Everyone can do something.
Julie Brigham Greedy, just tick off, I realize it's unfair to do it, but tick off a few bullet points of things that you say, look, these are things that are doable and these are things that are constructive that will help us combat and help us also accommodate the kinds of change we're going to see with the growth in CO2 in the atmosphere.
Well, I think it makes very clear economic sense to be shifting over to wind and solar. We still have many states in this country where your taxes increase if you have solar panels. So I think we can turn those efforts around and really try to change the sources of our energy. That's really imperative. And I think there's, just as Andy was saying, there's tremendous opportunity. When I talk to young people, say, you can be part of this change. You can be part of making this a better world as we both adapt and mitigate the problem. So, you know, I was just on a bicycle trip across Iowa, and there's wind farms all over the place there, generating revenue for local farmers and generating tremendous volumes of energy. But you might not think Iowa would be doing that politically, and the same can be said for Oklahoma and Texas, where we have tremendous wind power being generated. What's missing are some of the solar panel arrays that could be put in place as we shift our source of power over to more renewable, cleaner fuels.
And Andy Revkin, in the last minute we have, you know, you've looked at this from both sides of the telescope, both as a reporter and as now a communicator. As we communicate with policymakers, as we communicate with one another, as we talk to our children, are you thinking about how this issue is framed and how we talk about it?
Well, I've been a storyteller for 30 plus years, me telling you something. And that model for the media and or for scientific institutions or leadership is flawed when it's on an issue like this with complexity. It's about conversation. There are people in Oklahoma, there's a businessman who says God controls the environment, who has solar panels all over his house. This was a 2015 report by my buddy John Sutter at CNN. And, you know, so do you badger him about his disbelief of global warming, or do you say, hey, man, you know, I have other reasons that I think about renewable energy. What do we do about that? There's ways forward, but they're more about conversation than about storytelling sometimes.
Building bridges and policies. You've been hearing there from Andrew Revkin. He's director of the Initiative on Communication and Sustainability at the Earth Institute at Columbia University. Thanks for your time.
Great to be here.
And we're appreciative to Julie Brigham Greedy. She's professor of glacial geology at the University of Massachusetts. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our On Point team, well, it includes our producers Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller. We have help from David Marino and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik. Thanks for listening. This is On Point.